Hey, Tightrope family. We're popping back into your headphones this week to do something a little different and share a fantastic episode from our friends over at the Broken Record Podcast. On Broken Record, acclaimed producer Rick Rubin, best-selling author Malcolm Gladwell, producer Justin Richmond, and former New York Times editor Bruce Heldlam talk with the musicians you love about their lives, inspiration, and craft. So many legendary artists, including Nas, Missy Elliott, Michael Stipe, and Jack White have been featured on Broken Record, and in honor of Black Music Month this June, we're sharing a few Broken Record episodes with you. This week, you'll hear Bruce Heldlam's interview with Grammy Award-winning artist and Maroon 5 keyboardist PJ Morton. PJ shares what it was like growing up as a preacher's kid and how it impacted his relationship with gospel music. He talks about the biggest compliment he ever received. It was from Stevie Wonder, when after collaborating on a song together, Stevie told him that he wished he had written the song for himself. Talk about an accomplishment. PJ and Bruce also discussed PJ's new album, Watch the Sun, which was recorded as a result of a need to step back during the pandemic. It was recorded at a studio built in the 70s in Louisiana, where Stevie Wonder created his album, Journey Through the Secret Life of Plants. Okay, here's the episode. I hope you love Broken Record as much as I do. You can listen to more episodes of Broken Record from Pushkin Industries, wherever you listen to podcasts. We hope you enjoy.
Pushkin.
Hey everyone, today we begin our month-long celebration of Black Music Month with PJ Morton, the New Orleans-based singer-songwriter, producer, and keyboardist of Maroon 5. Morton recently earned a Grammy Award for Album of the Year for his contributions to Jean-Baptiste We Are. But even though he's been up for multiple Grammys, he almost gave up on the idea of a solo career altogether. But then he moved back home to New Orleans and reconnected with what got him interested in music in the first place. Now, Morton's releasing his 8th studio album, Watch the Sun. The new album is made up of 11 original songs and features collaborations with artists like Stevie Wonder, Nas, Jill Scott, and Wale. On today's episode, PJ Morton talks to Bruce Heldlam about what it was like growing up a preacher's son and how his relationship with gospel impacted the way he makes music. He also talks about being a recovering workaholic and his friendship with the great Stevie Wonder. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Bruce Heldlam and PJ Morton.
You played organ growing up, right?
Oh, yeah.
What was the organ in your church?
Yeah, like a B3.
Oh, it was? Okay.
Yeah, it was a B3. My brother-in-law taught me. I learned on the job, basically, and by ear, you know. But he taught me to draw bars and settings, and I kind of just built from there.
Yeah, I was amazed to hear that. Well, I heard it on your record. You said it. You don't read music.
I don't read music, yeah.
So you learned to play in church by ear?
By ear, yeah, 100%.
Wow.
It kind of blows my mind, you know, when I think about the things I can play. I just remember not being able to play, and then I remember being able to play. I don't really remember learning. Like, the only thing I remember, I would just play the same thing over and over, and then I would make a mistake, and my ear would say, oh, that's the chord from that song. Oh, that's how they did that. It literally, like, one foot in front of the other.
Now, your album, New Orleans, begins with a tape of your father, Paul S. Morton.
That's right. Yeah.
Introducing you at church.
Well, we were actually at home.
Oh, you were at home.
Yeah. So my dad, every year since like 1983, I mean, I remember the camcorders got smaller and smaller through the years, but that was the big one. Every year, though, we would have a talent showcase during Christmas. It was me and my sisters. We all had to do something. You know, my sister was a singer. You can see me through the years go from drums to trying to play guitar to finally you see me settle in on piano about 7 years old or eight, you know?
Okay.
And I think that was 8 or 9.
Do you remember what you played?
Yeah, I used to think I invented this. It was like, oh no. Da, 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 da. I really thought that I wrote that. I don't know why I thought that. But that was what I played. I remember that clearly.
Now, you were playing in church. Your father ran the church.
Oh, yeah. He was the pastor and, of course, an amazing singer as well. So music was really important.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what was the relationship between church music and secular music in your house? Because your dad is a very big gospel singer.
Yes. He's a very big gospel singer who also was born and raised in Windsor, Ontario, Canada. So he was right across the tunnel from Detroit. So there was so much music in gospel, of course, the Winans and Clark Sisters, but Stevie, all of that stuff that was happening as well. So there was a high appreciation for music in the house. And it was almost like you could listen to it, because not on Sundays. We weren't allowed to listen to secular music on Sundays on the radio. It had to be gospel music. But one of my dad's favorite singers was Anita Baker. I remember Michael Jackson and Prince and Stevie and Whitney Houston. I remember hearing that stuff in the household, too, here and there.
You know, one of your dad's big hits, Let It Rain.
Yes.
Which he did after Katrina. He does a little Purple Rain in there.
It's a little Purple Rain. Yeah, I used to travel with him as he ministered, you know, and did revivals and stuff. We would go full Purple Rain on there. So,
oh, is that right?
Yeah. So that's what I mean by the influence was always there. My dad is a musician. So, you know, as a musician, you can't pick and choose what's good and bad. I think it became more of an issue if you decided to be a recording artist doing that. You know, once you decided, oh, I'm going to be a secular artist, that is kind of when you started to get some pushback.
Okay. And did you get pushback from him?
I did. Yeah. Initially, I got pushback because I was a very young songwriter. So I think for a preacher's kid, it always comes off as rebellion at first. You know, he's just trying to go against what we're doing.
You were a PK.
I'm a PK. Yeah. I'm a PK. But for me, it was much purer than that. And it was coming from a real place. And I think once they realized it wasn't like a rebellious phase, they became like my number one supporters.
It wasn't, this is the family business.
Yeah, I felt that pressure initially. It's me and my two sisters. I'm the only boy. I'm his namesake. You know, the J is for Junior, you know. So it was almost like that path was written out for me. I mean, it was like, this is yours, you know. But for me, I didn't want that. And my dad never quite put that pressure on me. It was more coming from everybody else, members or like just in general, because my dad was known outside of just our church. Of course, he traveled all around the world. And I think everybody just assumed that. So I felt the pressure from everywhere. But internally, I think my dad saw something in me and saw that I was going to be different. And he eventually empowered me to do that.
He came around.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
I don't know the gospel style so well. Is there a lot of Detroit gospel in what your dad did?
Oh, yeah.
What's Detroit gospel? What's New Orleans gospel?
I think New Orleans gospel always felt like New Orleans music in general. It was, I think, the blues and the jazz of all of that was all mixed in. Detroit, at that time, when I was growing up, was always kind of ahead of the game. I mean, when you talk about the like the Clark Sisters, Twinkie, who was the producer and one of the lead singers of the Clark Sisters, it sounded like Stevie Wonder. It just had gospel lyrics. So they were pushing that line of it feeling like what current music was doing. She said she got that song from like Master Blaster, you know, but it's saying, you made my day. You made my way. So it was like very modern, you know, for that time. And New Orleans, I think, was still in the in a traditional sense.
Everybody says, well, he's a gospel piano player. And I don't really know what that means. People say, well, this is the gospel scale. And I think, well, that's just the scale everybody uses, isn't it?
Yeah, see, I think maybe gift and curse, but because I didn't learn music, I can't relate to any of that. I don't even know scales. So I don't, you know
really?
What I mean?
You don't know any scales?
No, I mean, I don't know what they are. You know, I know, but, and I know that's a G major scale, but I don't know what a gospel scale is. I mean, I guess some people would look down on that. Which is, there were some purists, you know, I have a weird relationship with some purists because I think the genius is being able to do it, you know, mm-hmm. without being taught. I think that before there was notation, somebody had to play it to write it. And I think somewhere along the line, notation became higher than being able to do it. But I take pride in the fact that it came through me. It comes through me, and that it's a gift that was given to me. I'm in a huge pop band. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I just play music, mm-hmm. whatever the moment calls for. So I don't really get into that. Or I'm not even sure what that means exactly. Yeah. Of course, I can play church music because that is my foundation, you know, but I don't know that I would consider myself a gospel mm-hmm. piano player.
Well, your friend, John Batiste.
Yeah.
He went to Juilliard.
Yes.
So you can just say to him, yeah, I didn't have to do that.
I mean, listen, I think those things, and it depends where you're taking it, right? I mean, he's able to score soul and like do all these amazing things, you know? These different things are tools for different paths. And he's undoubtedly a genius. I mean, when he sits at this piano, yes, he learned the notes, but you can't teach what he does. I remember, you know, a friend of mine who did go to Berkeley and came to start playing with me, he would tell me stuff like, that's wrong. Are you playing that wrong? And I was like, you know, there's no such thing. You know what I mean? And he had to eventually learn that. But I do think, yeah, because I don't know, it allows me to not know what the boundaries are supposed to be. And also the things that I listen to, I mean, when you talk about Stevie or you talk about Quincy, they would have different choices, you know, and these are the things that I grew up paying attention to. Well, the Beatles as well. I mean, when you talk about like different chords and different structures, those guys, they were all about it.
Can you show me, and maybe this will probably help listeners, well, you've done a couple great versions of How Deep Is Your Love.
Yeah.
And a lot of your music is like this, including your gospel music. Your gospel music sounds like love songs. Your love songs sound like gospel music, which is always nice. You're always like, is he talking about God? Or is he talking about...
You got to listen, right?
Yeah. So can you just show me when you probably heard that song growing up in the 80s because it was on radio. Mm-hmm. When you sat down to say, okay, I'm going to try and play it, what was that process like?
Yeah, what's so crazy is my sister and I used to transform songs from, I mean, Annie was our favorite movie growing up. So I would always already hear those songs a certain way. Like, so the Bee Gees are, how deep is your love? How deep is your love? I really mean to learn. Right? And for me, I heard it, how deep is your love? How deep is your love? I really mean to learn. Cause we're... That's church right there.
Living in a world. Okay, stop there. What's church about it?
Cause you just don't really, that's why I hear that voicing. When I say church, I mean the voicing of it. Cause I could have easily said, cause we're living in a world, right? But I said, cause we're living in a world of hope, breaking us down, you know? Yeah. So it's just some voicings that, I mean, some people call it church, some people call it soul. I hear it that way in my head.
Mm-hmm. And they're probably vocal lines originally, right? It's like a choir sound almost.
As far as what?
What you were just playing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That chord right there is like, you know, I use that a lot, like a dominant. But I hear those voicings, those harmonies. That's a very gospel thing as well, yeah.
Wow. Did you ever hear from Robin Gibb, or I guess Barry Gibb, pardon me.
Barry,
right?
Yeah. I did. Well, I heard from the social media account.
Okay, yeah.
So I talked to somebody, but no, I got word that they loved that version, and I'm honored, man. It was always one of my favorite songs, and it was a last minute decision to record it. It became one of, but I have to play that now, you know.
You recorded that on, is that on Gumbo?
It's on Gumbo, and then Gumbo Unplugged with Yubba.
Yeah.
And then I did it on the piano album again with Alex Isley, a totally different broken down piano version.
Yeah, which is a great, great. Your whole piano record is.
Oh, thank you, man.
Is fabulous. Did you study a lot of the traditional New Orleans players? You remind me of Alan Toussaint, maybe because you're a songwriter.
Yes.
And you accompany a lot of people.
I was a church kid, right? So I missed a lot of that. And because I didn't read, I didn't go through the traditional jazz path in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. You know, it kind of made me an outcast, actually, growing up there because I didn't fit into any New Orleans box, really. Alan Toussaint later on in life became a blueprint for me because he represented what I wanted to be, you know, which was New Orleans through and through, but really lend my hand outside of New Orleans as well in a big way. The way he had a studio in New Orleans that was all his own, you know, it was a blueprint for me. And you're right, the way he was a producer for a lot of different artists is how I saw myself. So Alan Toussaint was, he was the person I looked to say, that's what I want to be. But that came later on in life. He was a couple of generations ahead of me. But no, I didn't study in that way. I was studying gospel musicians, and then I got one like Chick Corea. And for me, though, although I was a musician, I was always drawn to the songs. It was always the songs over the playing, over the singing. So I never really studied outside of Chick, trying to learn Spain. I never really studied keys that way. I studied songwriters. So I was drawn to Stevie, of course. Like, that's what started it all for me.
Do you remember what the song or album was with him?
I do. I don't remember if it was an album, but a friend of mine gave me a cassette tape. And I knew, I'm an 80s baby, right? So I knew, I just called to say I love you and, you know, Part-Time Lover when I was, you know, I knew those songs, but I hadn't heard that early voice. And it was, I never dream you leaving somebody. That's that song, I can remember playing that cassette tape and hearing that and like my mind just like, why is this making me feel this way, you know? And soon after, he gave me Donny Hathaway Live. It seemed like that was happening all like back to back to back in my life. I don't remember how much there was a break in it. But then I heard the Beatles and I'm like, whoa, like, what are these melodies and how are they saying the same thing but a different way? And then that got me to James Taylor somehow. I actually was watching an award show and they were honoring him and they were playing Fire and Rain as he was walking up. And I was like, what is that?
You really were a church kid. You hadn't heard James Taylor.
I hadn't heard James Taylor. And I knew the big stuff, you know, but like it was a different mind as a songwriter. It was like I started to want to do that.
How old were you when you heard Stevie Wonder and Donny Hathaway?
That was like 12. Somebody gave me that stuff at 12. Like, again, I had heard Stevie and he was just a part of it, you know. I hadn't heard Donny, actually, but that was about 12 or 13. The Beatles, my mom told me stories because my name's Paul. And my little sister was born and she got a lullaby CD and it had Hey Jude on there. So I was really young at that time. I was probably 7. But I didn't really get to the Beatles until later.
So what was it like when you finally met Stevie Wonder? And how did you meet Stevie Wonder?
So, like, met in person, there were a couple of, like, quick ones. I remember Kirk Franklin is the first person that introduced me to him in person. But that was really quick. And then 2013, I had a song called Only One that I wanted him to play harmonica on. Didn't know him at all, but I just was like, you know, I'm just going to try. So I reached out to a drummer friend of mine, Teddy, who was played for him. And he hooked me up with a stylist of his who happened to be from New Orleans and happened to be familiar with me. So she was down to get him the song. If you can get it to him, it's two things. He's got to want to do it and you got to be able to get it to him, you know, but it's not like you can sell him on the idea of this being a good career move for him.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, he just got to want to do it.
He just could really break it for you.
Yeah. Man, Stevie, I'm telling you, if you just do this one, it's going to take you to the top. You know, it was none of that. I feel like he heard some of himself in it and was down, and he cut harmonica on it. That still hadn't met him in person. And then we were on a plane, and I didn't know he was sitting behind me. And I went to the restroom, and Stevie comes behind me, like, needing to use the restroom too. And I turn around, I'm like, Stevie, it's PJ, you just did my song. And he was like, oh, I love that song. And we connected then, and that was special. But it didn't really turn into a full relationship until maybe 3 years ago. He invited me to do Toys for Tots, his Christmas thing. And we did a song together. And we really started to build then after my album Gumbo first began. He told me he loved that song. He told me he wished that he wrote that song, which is, you know, I don't need any more compliments in life. That's it. You know, that's it for me. And so now we have a bond that is, and I'm not over it, but he told me, like, you can call me, like, you don't have to, you know, we're friends. I'm like, you're Stevie Wonder, though, you know. It's like more than I ever dreamed. That's the biggest thing I ever dreamed. So it's amazing.
Have you ever talked about songwriting with him?
We talk about it in a way. We more talk about life. But what's fascinating about Stevie to me is his recall. I don't have that. If I don't record it in my phone and like have a voice note, I'll forget something great. He'll recall 10 songs that he's never put out that he's got, and he'll just run through them. I think it just speaks to his genius, you know, that he can hold all of this stuff. Full songs. I mean, he'll play them for me. But we never really talked about technique or anything. I mean, I think he just appreciates what I do, and he tells me he's not bashful about telling me how much he supports me. I think that in general, I don't think that's unique to me. He's very encouraging to artists and writers that he believes in.
Now, you've done a lot of producing. I think you won your first Grammy for India Arie, I think.
Yeah, well, not technically. So I had to come back. I thought the Grammy rules. I didn't get a trophy for that album. I wrote and produced on the album, and it won Best R&B Album. But I didn't produce a certain percentage of the album.
Okay.
So I didn't get a trophy for it. But yeah, I was a part of this Grammy Award winning album my junior year in college. Yeah.
Wow. Did you take time off from college for that?
No, I went right. It made me want to quit. The only thing that got me through is I had one semester left. I finished Morehouse in 3.5 years. And that was my junior year, the first semester. And I was like, oh, this is all I want to do. Like, I got to get out of here. But I had like one more semester. So I'm like, let me knock this out.
That's the best summer job ever.
Oh, for sure.
I was mowing lawns. You were winning Grammys.
Man, it was amazing. I moved off campus my second year and met Indy Arie right there in the apartments we were living in. Well, her brother was living there, and she happened to be up there and heard me playing the piano. And we started talking about Stevie Wonder. And she hadn't put out her first Motown record yet. She let me hear that. And so when the other one came around, we were friends by then. And I had this little song and played it for her, and she loved it. And the rest was history.
And you'd never produced before that?
I had produced some gospel stuff.
Yeah.
Because my first placement as a producer was when I was 16.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 15 I did the song. 16 it came out. And so I kind of was used to it a little bit. But that, in my mind, that is the first thing that I truly produced.
But then after a couple of your own albums, you were gonna stop doing solo stuff.
Yeah.
Why? What was going on?
Yeah, right before Gumbo, I was just, Gumbo was going to be the last thing. I think for me, I had been pushing independently for a long time. And, you know, it's an uphill battle. I mean, it can be, you know. And I just felt like I didn't necessarily fit in. I would give these songs, I could write songs for other people, but when I did my presentation, it was just kind of like the labels didn't get it. You know, we went to every label at one time and couldn't get signed. And I just felt like, all right, listen, I was in Maroon 5 a few years by then, mm-hmm. and I'm like, you know, this is great. I mean, I'm fine, you know, I'll still produce and write. And I think part of it was I just wasn't successful at being myself, or it just hadn't come together. You know, so then I signed a major deal. I was with Young Money, with Lil Wayne and Universal. And that was cool. It was a learning experience. But then that didn't work out. So I asked to get off the label. And I was indie again. And I'm like, you know what? I'm leaving LA and I'm leaving all of this. Like, I just, you mm-hmm. know. So Gumbo kind of was I was just disarmed. You know, I wasn't thinking about anything business wise, radio, PR, none of that. I just was like, I'm just going to make what I want to make. Which I realize now that that's what was missing. Just me overthinking some things. Yeah, I was making good songs and doing all of this, but I wasn't fully connecting because I had those blocks and I wasn't creating fully in a free way. Not since my very first album. It just put me back where I was supposed to be, I guess.
Because
that's when a lot of the more recent success started.
Yeah, and you've got your own studio now.
Yeah,
got your own label.
Studios, got my own, yeah.
Yeah.
Morton Records, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you're still producing for other people.
Producing. And we just, Snow Allegra, shout out to Snow Allegra. She was just up at the Grammys for a song that I helped write. No, I'm going to continue to do that. I just love other voices. I love other expressions. So I always want to lend my hand when I can add something.
And you're going to restore Buddy Bolden's house.
Yes, yes, yes. It was a happy mistake that happened after Katrina. It was a house not far from my parents' church, literally steps away. So the church bought up most of the land after Katrina and happened to buy this house not knowing.
Now we should explain who he is.
Because that's part of where my passion comes from, because I didn't know who he was growing up, unfortunately, and we all should. Buddy Bolden, the legend has it that he is the seed that planted jazz music. The story is that he was playing his horn too loud in the house. So his mom told him, go outside. He goes on the stoop and plays it. The legend says you could hear him all the way, like, across town. And so a friend of his heard him playing, and they formed the band that majority of the world says is the first time they heard jazz music. He died at a young age. He died mental illness, you know.
There's a theory that he had a vitamin deficiency.
Is that right?
Which is very common, apparently.
Wow.
If you were poor, and that it wasn't, you know, because people assumed it was schizophrenia, because I think he ended up in an asylum, but it may have actually been
a breakdown.
It may have been a nutritional.
Wow.
Yeah.
Something so simple now, right?
Yeah.
But, like, seemed complex then. But I just think his story is important. There's literally one picture of him that exists, mm-hmm. no recordings.
Yeah.
And we're still talking about him 100 years later. So. Mm-hmm. He did something, you know?
Yeah. King Oliver played in his band. Different people
That's
played
right.
in his band.
That's right. And that these are the people who carried on his story.
Yeah.
So we got this house, which was actually low-income housing before Katrina. It wasn't, nobody was making a big deal about it,
yeah.
which is probably why my parents didn't know.
Right.
So it's been sort of an uphill battle just because it was new for me. I was just excited about it. But never been in the nonprofit space, never had to raise money for anything. But this vision, man, is so important. It's the house that he actually lived in. And then there's an identical house right next to it. So I'm calling it the past house and the future house. So I want his actual home, the left side of it, to be a small museum. Just the lineage of New Orleans, which I think is not only jazz, but really American music, you know. Our jazz didn't really turn into contemporary jazz. It turned into R&B with Fats and those guys. And I feel like Elvis was chasing Fats, you know, and,
sure.
and became rock and roll, you know. So I just think that it's an important story to tell. So we want to do the museum, and then the right side where he actually lived will be his house as it was lived in. And then the right house, I want to make like an event center to continue that innovation. I want to teach everything from except performance, really, because I think New Orleans has that covered. But I want to teach the things that maybe left him to die broke, you know, teach publishing and teach songwriting and teach engineering and law. So I'm really excited about it. It has taken much longer than I wanted it to, but I'm still inspired and still passionate about the project. And can't wait to see it come to fruition fully.
I do want to talk about this new album,
yeah.
Watch the Sun.
Yeah, of course.
Tell me about the recording of this album. Tell me what you were thinking going into it.
Yeah, well, I wasn't really planning on doing an album. I just was coming off of a like crazy run. I mean, I just went back to back with music more than I ever had before, actually. But it just was rolling. So I was rolling with it. And then we got shut down. I was with Maroon 5 in South America. In real time, the show started to get canceled. We had to fly back to the States. And when we got back initially, I have voice notes from like March 2020. I was in this creative, like, it was just coming faster than I could even control it. And I got some music beds that actually ended up on this album 2 years later. But my laptop crashed like right after that. And I lost all that stuff. All
really?
I had was the voice notes.
You couldn't, nobody could get it back?
I got a lot of my files back, a lot of my drums back, but not those new songs that I was mm-hmm. working on. It was just not saved yet. It was pretty
always tough. Back up for the musicians
oh,
at
oh
home.
Oh my
yeah.
God, please. Yeah, I know this too. Like this is, what I did was it got bad and I probably could have recovered it. I went further than I should have and got this something offline that said it could save my files, and it just, my computer did something I've never seen before. It was so bad. I was just desperate. But what I realized was I needed to stop, like just stop, you know, and not not do anything. It's okay. Like, I'm just, you know, I say I'm a recovering workaholic. So I took that time to really focus on family, focus on life, taught my two youngest how to ride bikes. I mean, just really, I was building bookcases and bikes and all kind of stuff, you know. So I had these music beds because I wanted to start with just music, no lyrics. And I usually don't do that. I go pretty quick after I have music. I usually go in and write it. But I wanted to be so intentional this time around, like more intentional than that I've ever been, more honest and open than I've ever been. And so I took that time to just have the music beds. Then we moved into Gumbo Studios and I started to build it even more. Still music, no lyrics. And maybe about a year after that, I told my engineer, Reggie, that we should find a studio where we could live there.
So you just built a studio and then you wanted to use a studio somewhere else.
Because, you know, I don't know if people realize, but when we were all shut down, we lost all these gigs, but it was replaced with live streams and like more interviews than ever, really, because you were there, you know? So I feel like I wasn't away enough, you know, like I needed an away from the away. So I was like, I just need to go away. And we discovered studio in the country in Bugaloosa, Louisiana, where Stevie did Secret Life of Plants. There's a Frankie Beverly and Mays album that was made out there. I hear there's an unreleased Bette Davis record that was recorded out there. But this amazing studio that was built in the 70s, and there's a house on the grounds that you can stay at. Me and the band, and this was the first time we were even starting to, you know, I remember we had to test to go out there. First time we were around people without masks. And so that was freeing in itself. And this place was so magical, it just made me want to write immediately. Like, that's all I wanted to do. I threw myself into it. And this is the first time I started to write some lyrics. I feel like I had finally processed these things I want to say. And we just started building. I had the band. So how it would go is I'd wake up, because I wake up pretty early every day, and go in myself, go to the piano, write, come up with some ideas. And then I'd call the band in to hit the parts that I wanted to hit. And first week of us being there is majority of the album as far as sonically. Yeah, a couple of the vocals. I ended up cutting vocals later. Reggie and I went again. I mean, we did four trips to the country. I didn't fully started singing into the second time. It just was an experience. It felt magical and it felt deeper than just records at this point. It's like, I really was, by being as honest and authentic as I was trying to be, I think it is going to connect to people. I've seen it that I've let people hear now, but I think it's going to connect in another way. After you made as much music as I've made, it's almost like that was all that was left at this point, was for me to, give you more of myself. Because the type of songwriter I am, there's always myself in it. But I also, in general, bring other people's stories. I'm a people watcher, you know. But this time was a lot more specific to me.
Can you play a little bit of a song that came out of that first week?
Yeah, well, Please Don't Walk Away. I said this on the piano album just as a passing thing, where before I sang to my wife, I said that, you know, this has been like the toughest, I said year, or, you know, it's been a rough period for us. But that was true. We had really gone through some challenges. You know, been married 13 years, got married really young. So Please Don't Walk Away was literally the first song I think I wrote lyrics to.
Yeah, I hope it did the trick.
It did. No, she didn't walk away, all is well. We're good now,
you said,
man.
Yeah, I can't write another one like that. So that was fabulous.
Right. Yeah, what's crazy is we were in a good space then. Like, it's almost like I have to process it and go through it first in order to talk about what I can't really talk about what's happening while it's happening, right. Usually.
Yeah, but a lot of the albums, very heartfelt, very...
Yes. Vulnerable, I would say.
Yeah, it's very much about breakups or the possibility of breakups. It's a tough album.
Sure.
When you sat down, you know, you play that for your band, and then you don't write music, so how do you arrange it with them?
Yeah, well, thankfully, I mean, well, I do have... you know, Berkeley graduates with me and stuff. So, but thankfully, all my guys around me are also church cats the way I grew up. So we communicate in a different way. it's not through, you know, sheet music. It's through just talking. You know, I can call out a two or a five or a one, you know, or four. So I know enough where we can communicate musically. It's not because I didn't go through school. It's not that I don't understand the movements of things. We just kind of have come up with our own language, I guess. Mm-hmm.
It's a shame they had to go to Berkeley, really.
Shout out to Brian.
takes him so long. So what's next for you?
I am going to get on the road. You know, I miss that so much. We just did a few shows, and I can't wait to play this new stuff live. I mean, it's made for it. I thought of the album in that way. The album just continues like my shows do. You know, it's not really a lot of break in there. They just flow from one to the other. And I just can't wait to present that to everybody. And really it's the community. I think it's me, that church, growing up in church and having that weekly community where you share this experience. I just can't wait to share this experience of this really honest music with my supporters. So that's next. I'm scoring an animated film right now.
Okay, what's that like?
It's fun, man. Well, in my case, because the director is a fan of mine. Like, you know, he really already digs what I do. I imagine it could be frustrating when somebody is just, you're just put in a position to do it. But this guy wants PJ songs. So it's so cool because this story is so weird that it allows me to go places that I would never get to go in my own music. So it's like PJ doing weird, different, cool stuff. It's really exciting for me. I'm enjoying that process. So there's that. There's some TV shows that I'm scoring as well. I like that side of it too, because my music is so visual that I like when I have to create to a visual. It's pretty fun.
So recovering workaholic, huh?
Yeah, in my sense, you know, even like this big tour, this is new for me, brand new for me, where in the summer we'll do 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, something I've never done in my life. But I understand now that just as much as I plan for these things, I have to actually plan for the other stuff that's important to me. So we'll see how that goes. But 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off is a big start for this recovering workout.
Okay, let's see how that works.
We'll see. I'll check back in.
Okay. It's been fabulous. And the album is fabulous. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me, man.
Playing just so beautifully.
It's been a pleasure.
It's a great album.
Thank you, sir.
It's a real treat.
All right.
Thanks to PJ Morton for taking us through his incredible career as a solo musician and a sideman. You can hear all of our favorite PJ Morton songs on a playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Ben Tolliday, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez, with engineering help from Nick Chafee. Our executive producer is Mia LaBelle. And if you like the show, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.